Welcome to Tosnua, and his name is Joe C. He said the God shite ain't for me. This Canadian rock star slash author needed some relief, made worldwide news when he started Beyond Belief. She loves your book, but you're the worst Zoom bouncer according to Jen B. Thank you, Joe, for speaking.
I think no more needs to be said. My name's Joe. If I'm kicking it old school and I'm an alcoholic, or as the cool kids say, I have substance use disorder. Welcome, Joe. Victim of substance use disorder. Gotta rock that victim moniker. So trying to get a feel for the room. Of course, I can go for 5 minutes or weekend retreat. So there's a lot of material to draw from. Just curious, how many people here are looking at ahead to their first or second like sober holiday season? And how many are just old farts? So there's a little bit of that. And then there's my good friends, the Kajadi old timers. I'm going to start with what's going on for me right now, because often I run out of time or forget all about it. I do write, and I've developed in my later sobriety, I've developed an interest in history, the history of AA, the history of the recovery movement. I've earned a seat in more than one 12-step fellowship, so I know AA, but I'm not unfamiliar to adult children of alcoholics, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, Al-Anon, Narcotics Anonymous, and there's other places I've gone just to support others, Debtors Anonymous and Marijuana Anonymous, so on and so forth, and I love their literature. I go to Refuge Recovery, I go to Life Ring, anywhere where alcoholics and addicts are, I'm gonna hang out, and I've earned my seat there. There may be no dues or fees, but we do pay a price to, the cost of membership is dear for sure, and I qualify. When I was new in recovery, because I was so young, I had little interest in regaling past glories of Alcoholics Anonymous and canonizing the founders for what they had done. I was more concerned about looking to the future. What could we do to make AA better or more palatable for the sufferers still to come? And because I was sort of drawn to sort of like the young people's community in Montreal where I got sober, that's what we were talking about. We weren't reading old literature from the past. We were, some did, of course, but we were thinking, this is great. There's a young people's presence, but where's everybody else? What can we do to make AA's never going to be where the cool kids hang out. That's just a fact, right? Any one of us, if we could still kick it at being the life of the party, shits and giggles, drinks and sex and rock and roll, I'd still be doing that, right? I love being sober, and in today's world, there's never a problem that's so bad that a drink wouldn't make worse. And nothing I enjoy so much that, I need a little something extra just to get the full experience. So I've learned to live a meaningful, sober life, but I didn't choose it. I didn't say, that's what I want to be when I grow up, an AA member. Yeah, I'm going to be famous. I had what I thought were more lofty goals, but So I remember in service meetings, there'd always be people from archives, and I would joke that there's no future in archives, you know, and I would sort of, you know, look down on, or I had no patience for, reading AA Comes of Age or any of that stuff. But if you care about the future and you are ignorant to your past, you're going to have flawed mechanisms. It's important to learn. And honestly, I didn't start getting a real interest in AA until it affected me personally, until my group was kicked out of Toronto Intergroup's meeting list for not being AA. And I said, what do you mean not being AA, right? You can't tell us we're not AA. If we want your opinion, we'll give it to you. You're Intergroup, we're the AA meeting, you work for us, right? And but not everybody in Toronto saw it that way. And I really went to school about wanting to know more. I mean, it didn't start there. When I was sober 10 years and I was living in Toronto by then, I lived in Calgary, Alberta for a while, moved to Toronto. And one of my sort of running mates, a friend in sobriety, bought me Pass It On. It had just come out. It was a history written by Mel B about AA. And it was a very thoughtful gift. All the group members signed it. I still have it. It's the first edition. I'm happy to have it. And I started reading about AA history, it's a pretty adventurous past for sure. And I started getting interested in this and that, and it definitely paid dividends. But right now what I'm kind of on about is the sort of history of sort of fundamentalism in AA and the free thinkers movement. And they seem to be like a yin and a yang. They seem to be, you can't have one without the other. The more of one creates more of the other. And this sort of polarization, AA didn't create it. We're just a microcosm of what's going on outside. But I've gone back listening to old tapes that I used to listen to when I was new, just to see if I was kidding myself about the good old days. We tend to sort of glorify, our youth and our past a little bit. But I wanted to hear from my peers and those who came before me, what their early sobriety was like. Because if you hang around a lot of Toronto meetings, you would be sure the first 100 members practiced exactly the same process for getting sober. They all did that together, and then they taught it to the next 100, and they taught it to the next 100, and so on and so forth. And she told someone, and she told someone, and on it went. And the process they're talking about, I'll listen to, I'll go, okay, I could see how that works. Okay, that makes sense to me. That's logical. But that's not my story. That's not how it worked for me. So is there a place for me in AA? And I started wondering in AA whether, this sort of big book fundamentalism, which is just a style, and I'm not saying free thinkers are so much more woke, and fundamentalists are, killing AA. They're getting people sober, and a lot of people sober, and they are a living example of the fact that what they're doing is working. But it's not the only way. And I was encouraged to hear that what I was saying about the past, I wasn't making up. It wasn't a revisionist history. I often talk about how, I didn't go to my sponsor for answers, and he didn't go to the book for authority. That wasn't my experience. He always put it back at me, right? He answered my questions with questions. I found it frustrating. I just wanted a nice concrete answer to an abstract problem, and he wouldn't give it to me. And, you know, because it was my recovery he was concerned about, not me modeling his recovery. And to do that, I was going to have to do it my own way. And but I started second guessing myself. I thought, well, was everybody else reading the book, the first 164 days pages, just like the founders did, yada, yada, yada. And I found out they weren't. You listen to early Clancy stories, and he read the big book, but it didn't get him sober. He was living in a car and drinking, and he read the book, but it, no white light experience. It wasn't until he got engaged with AA that he got sober. And I relate to that. I had, it was the people in AA, not a, any sort of supernatural power, not any sort of process. It was your example that got me sober. I just listened to one of these old recordings by someone named Tommy, and she got sober in 1960. She was giving a talk in 2008 in Nashville. So she's sober since 1960. So she's, you know, the era of Bill Wilson. And she spent a lot of time actually with Ebby in his last days, convalescing him. He died sober. And he spent some time with, she spent some time with the Wilsons. And she didn't have a sponsor until she was a year sober. And she started working the steps because, you know, her, you know, sobriety didn't solve her problems. And I relate to that too. It, for me, sobriety exposed my problems because I was treating my problems with my addiction. And so being sober, you know, for some people, you know, their job gets better, their relationships get better, their health gets better. They got the white eyes, the white teeth, the coin in the pocket. They are good, right? They, you know, that, you know, that's their sobriety. Not me. I just, I was full of doubt. I was panicky. I was, I just didn't know which way was up. I just, you know, I was barely hanging on, I felt. And that's why I started looking to the steps for answers. And I had issues with the language, and, you know, I remember sharing recently my, I was challenging my sponsor in some of the language. It could have been the word powerless. Who knows what I was fighting over? Insanity. I'm not insane. What, you have to be insane to be in AA, or it could be God. It could have been any of those things. And I remember him saying, well, genius, if you're the wordsmith, what's a better word? Change the word. The word won't mind. What you gonna do, right? So he would always put it back on me. And to this day, I encourage anybody, if they're gonna work the steps, and I know plenty of great examples of sobriety in AA, long-term sobriety, people who give to the community, people who give back to AA, who either didn't work the steps or didn't finish the steps, but I did. They are definitely part of my story, and this story that Tommy told, I learned something new about one of our founders, Bill Wilson, and she was talking about going to visit him, and like he died of emphysema, and our other sort of co-founder died of cancer too, right? I mean, they died of, you know, manageable, preventable illnesses that are, you know, based on addiction. Both of them were heavy smokers, right? But Bill Wilson actually quit smoking. She told the story of driving up to their Stepping Stones place, and Bill ran out in the middle of the winter in his t-shirt just to greet them, and said, well, what are you doing out here? You know, he goes, I quit smoking for a year now. I should have done it 10 years ago. And I didn't know that. I thought, no, how about that? And then she also told the story of how a bunch of people were gathering in the kitchen. And there was one guest, a woman who was staying with the Wilsons. And as everyone sort of gathered in the kitchen, she was she was depressed. She went into the living room and just sort of lay down on the couch. And Bill excused himself and went and talked to her. It was really moving. You know, like we all know he loved the limelight and he could sure milk a story and all that sort of thing. But her experience of him was, in a minute, he would rather just spend time with one suffering alcoholic. And that's quite a legacy. And the guy who wrote Physician, Heal Thyself, it's been in the big book since the second edition. He was like a young buck around 1953 when he got sober. He wrote another book in 1989 with the same title, Physician, Heal Thyself, 35 Years of Adventures in Sobriety by an AA Old-Timer. He was a San Francisco doctor. And this is a lot more story than his first, 10 months of sobriety. And it's really interesting. He talks about the four I's going through his life in sobriety. And we're not talking 35 days or weeks, but 35 years. The infatuation stage, the irritability stage, the inventiveness stage, and the insight stage. And I relate to this. I resisted AA, and then once I got engaged in AA, I thought people who weren't in AA just didn't get it, right? like we were somehow the in crowd. I was quite a fan. And then there was this irritability. I just didn't like the way, people were running the meeting I belonged to. And, they should do this, they should do that. Why is the service structure so slow and blah, blah, blah. And then the inventiveness stage, we've all started a meeting. That's part of the inventive stage, right? The resentment and the coffee pot, nothing bad about that, right? I know people who got sober despite somebody else doing it their way and not listening to their old sponsor. That's going to keep you sober. That's fine. You're going to get inventive. And then insight comes, in time. And, a lot of people are studying us, studying AA, and AA has proven by academics to be as effective or better than any other sort of, cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational enhancement therapy. A lot of the things you go to a clinic for and get clinical care, they're all good. Probably a combination of them is even better. But AA holds up against the newer peer-to-peer groups. Other people have found things that work just as well. No one's found anything, according to researchers, that is particularly better. And I'm just going to talk about my walking through AA by something that came out, a book by a guy named David Best. He wrote a book in 2009 called Pathways to Recovery and Assistance, The Role of the Social Contagion of Hope. Because one of the things they're trying to find out is, what's the secret sauce, right? People who join AA have better outcome rates than people who don't, or some other mutual aid group. But is it God? Is it sponsorship? Is it working the steps? Is it service in AA? So they're trying to find out what it is. And in this book I've recently read, they talk about the model of the sort of 5 points of people who succeed, who find sustainable long-term recovery. And it's called CHIME. It involves a sense of community, hope, identity, meaning, and empowerment. And that's my story of recovery. There is nothing more isolating than addiction, right? No matter how much I was at one time, life of the party, good time Charlie, I got along with people. the more I got into my addiction, the more isolated I got, the more I hid my behavior from others, the more alone I became, the more I felt like I didn't belong anywhere. Everyone felt more, looked like they were more comfortable than I felt inside. I just, and then I came to AA and it's me and them, and I didn't feel us and any of that sort of thing. I had no sense of community, but the community sort of embraced me and brought me in. And what are you doing tomorrow, Joe? Oh, I don't know. Want to go to a meeting? Oh, okay. And so I'd go to another meeting. And what meetings did I go to? Whatever one that car was driving to, right? Like I wasn't sort of in control of my own destiny. I just sort of followed along. And I developed hope. And the hope came from the community, because I tried AA before. I didn't get sober the first time I tried it. I was 14 years old when I came to my first AA meeting. And when I say came, I didn't think I better go to AA. I was going to AA to get somebody else off my back. I was, it wasn't my idea. It was just, okay, I'll go, all right, already. And, you know, I could see why AA worked. I could see it was great. It was helping these old farts, but I just didn't relate. I didn't see it as working for me, and I did not think I was a life worth saving. And then when I started coming around to AA with Ernest, I was bringing my cousin, who was from Toronto. I lived in Montreal. She was coming from Scarborough, Ontario, a suburb of, and she'd been in group homes. She was an intravenous drug user. She was in the sex trade. She was 16. She was like in problems with the law. The story I heard was she wanted to get clean and sober and straighten up her life. And I love my cousin Elaine. Like I hardly saw her, but we were a month and a day apart in age, and I was going to help her, and I took her to meetings. How complicated could that be? I'll take her to meetings. I'll show her around. I'll show her the ropes. And I joined a group to be an example to her. I got the hope came from the experience of others, because I started going from AA could never work for me to AA works for them. Maybe I'm not so different. To wait a minute, these people are actually having more meaningful lives, more peak experiences in their sobriety than they did when they were drinking. What's their secret? So I got intrigued. And then identity, you know, using drugs was part of my identity. I was part of the niche crowd. I was part of the rebels. I was part of the sort of, not going along. It was my rugged individualism. And so it was like a mourning to actually have to give it up, because I didn't really know what my identity was, what made me cool. I didn't know. And the experience of being with other people in recovery, statistically, they say that someone who is an addict, substance use disorder sufferer, goes through treatment, goes back into the community. If they know at least one other person in recovery, they have a 27% better chance of never drinking again or whatever their drug of choice is than if they don't know anybody. Like if they go back to a partner who uses, back to the crack house, back to a working environment where drinking is sort of glorified or certainly enabled, they're going to have a harder time than someone who knows just one person in recovery. So I started developing an identity as someone in recovery. Like it wasn't an embarrassment. It wasn't a failure. It wasn't a lacking. I can't that. It was I'm this. This identity of recovery just became just sort of part of me, and it didn't happen boom, someone told me this and then I got it, right? It was a very gradual thing. And I found meaning in light in AA, and I found meaning outside of AA too. And then the the last of that sort of Chang thing is an empowerment. And, you know, addiction is very crippling to any of us. And the empowerment comes from, you know, the strength of two. I have a good friend who died of cancer, but died sober. He was in 4 different treatment centers, 2 of them 12-step, 2 of them non-12-step. And he was the only person that, you know, sort of hung with him through all of it. His brother wasn't even returning his calls, and he was in this hospital bed. And he just said to himself, I don't want to die a drunk. And like, he was definitely a hardcore atheist. He had a hard time with AA, but he developed what he called a higher purpose. He didn't want to die a drunk. He gave up a high paying sales job. He did very well for himself, and to become a drug and alcohol counselor. He was a great contributor to our group, and one of the founding members of Beyond Belief in Toronto. Wayne was his name. And he used to always, never got this higher power stuff, but he talked about his higher purpose. First, it was he didn't want to die a drunk. And then it was the joy he found, the sort of 1 + 1 = 2, right? Two alcoholics together, there's something else going on there that's more than just two individuals going it alone. And he really sort of tapped into that, and died a happy man for sure. And that kind of empowerment, it's like the force, I suppose, in a way. There is nothing in life that I'm afraid of that I would think, I would do that, but only if I could drink. Like, I'll get up on stage and play guitar, which, you know, I'm an introvert, I'm not an extrovert, but I'll do it with other people, right? And I'll do it sober, and I'll talk in front of a room full of some strangers, some not, you know, like there's nothing that I need. I can't find my own internal empowerment for, and that came from Alcoholics Anonymous. Was it from working the steps? It probably helped. Was it from getting active in service and helping other alcoholics? Yeah, that probably helped. Was it from getting a job and developing a sense of mastery at something outside of AA and being a contributor to my household and, taking good care of myself physically? That helped too, right? I don't think there is a secret sauce, but I'm definitely sure that this CHIME idea, there's something to it. Community, hope, identity, meaning, and empowerment are the things that sort of get me through. And it's way easier, I think, to sort of hold on to that than go out there and be stuck in the, faced with, you go to see someone and they've got a drink on the table. Would you like one, right? If you're not used to that environment, when you're been sort of removed from that, what step is this? Let me think, can I call a sponsor? It's 5 ideas, right? I've got a recovery community. What would they say, right? Other people have gotten through this, right? I am a sober person living in long-term recovery, and I don't need that. And that kind of just creates that sort of empowerment to get through. I got sober in November, which will tell you I didn't have a plan, right? Anyone who gets sober right before, like, all the holidays start, wasn't planning on still being sober New Year's Eve, right? Like, I was just, sort of a day at a time kind of, running by the seat of my pants. So I wasn't thinking, okay, now's a good time to get sober. But then I was sober a while and starting to panic, right? Like the December, what's the date today? It's the 12th, right? You know, my first year would have been New Year's, right? Like, you do that sober? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you do? Well, this or that. Joe, you seem worried. Yeah, well, New Year's, like I've never gone through New Year's sober. Well, let's see if you get through December 12th, Joe. And we'll worry about December 13th tomorrow, right? Let's not worry about New Year's just yet, right? I was encouraged to just sort of keep it a day at a time. And it pays great dividends now. I do COVID one day at a time. I'm trained in sort of one day at a time, one breath at a time kind of thinking. And it has really become a way of life, but I didn't invent it. I didn't find it. It wasn't taught to me. It was a combination of all of those things. It was, I sort of modeled myself after others. And then I said, it's like trying on clothes, right? Not everyone wears the same thing. Not everything fits the same. So you try different things on. You go, oh, this is good, but I want something that's too restrictive, and you try something else. And AA has to be that way. Find your own AA. Because it's the only AA that's going to work for me is my AA, right? Patrick's AA isn't going to work for me. Jeb's AA isn't going to work for me. Karen's or Zanner's AA isn't going to work for me. When the chips are down and I'm sort of faced with that dilemma, I'm going to need my AA. And let's see, we started at 1, we're at 1:39. The only other thing I'll say is recovery isn't, sort of socioeconomic, upwardly mobile, everything's going to get better experience for everybody. If you think that's how AA goes, that's because you listened to a 10-minute talk and it sounded pretty amazing. It's way better than it was then. But I have had grief and loss, and I've had to return to other 12-step fellowships because of other addictive problems I've had. And I felt like a failure. At 20 years sober, I was planning my 20-year sober speech. At about 1 year sober, I thought, I'll be 36, 20 years sober, I'll be president of AA by then, And, I thought that was really going to be something, right? But at 20 years sober, I was estranged from my daughter who'd been abducted by her mother. I was in a custody battle with my son's mother. I had like two boy meets girl on AA campus romances. And, it just like everyone's an example in AA, but at 20 years sober, I was a bad example, looking back, all of that stuff was sort of age appropriate stuff, the misadventures of youth and yada, yada, yada. The space I was in at 20 years sober was I felt at the emotionally lowest I would ever been. I was now HIV positive. I didn't know where my daughter was. I was trying to make the best for my son and sort of solve this problem and resolve this matter with my daughter. I was isolating. I was feeling very lonely and, not sorry for myself, but I didn't want to be paraded up in the front as some power of example, right? I just did not want to be Mr. AA. When are you going to have your medallion, Joe? And I just put off. I never had it. I never had my 20-year medallion, although I planned it for 19 years. And, that is just my sobriety. If we live long enough, we are going to face loss like we've never known before. That's just part of life. And I see some people nodding, and I know you know grief, and I know you know loss. And some of you I've been through that with. And some of us have had to start over again. And it isn't like we lose everything we earned, and it doesn't delegitimize the sobriety we once had if we're starting again, with alcohol or some other, sort of addictive behavior. It's just part of the seeking process. we're not finders, we're seekers. And I'm still seeking. And in my sobriety, I will borrow a line from Ernie Kurtz, which he said, we must thirst. It's who we are. But where are we going to direct that thirst? And I've learned to find more creative and more constructive ways to direct my thirst. I can't expel it from me. I can't be content with life. I'm not the kind of guy that's just going to be, retiring on a beach, playing golf and checking my financial account, right? Like I go towards the fire. I mean, that's just who I am. That's just how I live. It's just, the idea of peace and happiness, it just sounds like a horror movie to me. And, I wish I was simpler, at times, but I'm not. And I've learned to just sort of figure out who I am, do as good a job as I can at being who I am, stop with this perfectionistic, I've got to do it better, I've got to do it right, develop a meaningful relationship with reality, with reason, with seeing things as they are to the best I can. I'm in a long-term relationship with someone that I don't see them how they are. I see them how I am, right? I have a sponsor and I know him and he knows me better than anybody, but I don't, we can only see so far into the soul of another. And, that's just one of our limits, right? And I live within those limits. I'm not trying to transcend the human experience with my sobriety. I'm just trying to, have the right to play the game, right? I just want a piece on the board. I just want to be in the game and see how it goes. And that's more than enough. Thank you for your patience.